It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soft Rep Radio. I'm Soft Rep Editor-in-Chief Sean Spoons. I'm filling in for Steve Balistrieri today, who is recovering from minor surgery. So he's going to be just fine. Don't worry about him. Today, our guest is Taylor Gregan. And Taylor is a former aviation rescue swimmer. And he's made a documentary called Hell or High Water, which is about his post-military service journey from PSD to recovering and healing. It's a really fascinating story, much like Homer's epic poem, the Odyssey, about the king of Ithaca. Odysseus was the king of Ithaca, and he made a journey that took, I think, about a year, coming back from the siege of Troy, and the journey that Taylor and his shipmates made took him from Pensacola, Florida, all the way to Cape Horn on the southern tip of South America, one of the most treacherous places for mariners in the entire world. It's the reason they built the Panama Canal, was because so many people and ships were lost trying to sail Cape Horn. I'm particularly happy to be doing this interview today with Taylor because I was an aviation rescue air crewman myself. So to meet another one, to talk to another one, is such a rare thing. There's so few of us in the Navy. You almost never see another one. So, Taylor, welcome to Soft Rep Radio. We're very happy to have you.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's cool. It's cool indeed. It is rare. Small community.
So, right. We're like unicorns. It's like you meet another one, and you go, you are a SAR swimmer? No kidding. And I think we talked when we were talking before, so I've only ever met one other guy in like 25 years that was a rescue swimmer like you and I were. It was like, oh my God. And kind of funny thing, I asked him, he was with an HSC squadron like you were, which is a sea control squadron. For those of you who are uninitiated, the sea control squadrons are almost the dedicated combat search and rescue squadrons in the Navy. And that is differentiated from the HSL squadrons, which tend to do more any submarine warfare off of frigates and destroyers. And when I told him I was an HSL guy, he goes, oh, you must have got good grades in A school. Which is kind of true, because if you were like, didn't get good grades in A school, you ended up with the H3 squadron, you know, the HS squadrons and stuff. So it was, you had to pick your orders based on your class standing. And if you don't know this, our publisher, Brandon Webb, who is a Navy SEAL, he started as a aviation rescue swimmer as well. And he was in HS squadrons. He was on the Kitty Hawk and he was on the Abe Lincoln and then went over to the Navy SEALs. Used to be that the number one rating for guys to transition over to SEAL teams was search and rescue guys. They always are looking for some other thing. So let's talk a bit about your background. You grew up in East Texas, Galveston Bay area. moved around a little bit. Tell us a little bit about that. You were born when? How old are you now?
Yeah, I'm 29. And
29, okay.
So my grandparents had a place in Galveston. We'd go stay with them. My dad, he lived in Dickinson, which is where I live now. And then we lived in Huntsville, and then a little town called Malakoff out in East Texas. And then family had some land out in San Angelo. We got to, and now most all of my family lives out in San Antonio. And that's where I lived whenever I got out of the Navy. It was in San Antonio before I went to Pensacola.
I've been out that way. Beautiful town, San Antonio. I spent a little time on a ranch out in Bandera, which is, you know, out even further west of you in that part of the hill country. It's gorgeous there.
Beautiful land, yeah.
You decided you wanted to be a swimmer. You wanted to join a swim team. The documentary talks a little bit about that. You walked down there full of piss and vinegar. I'm going to just take over this pool and got a rude awakening. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I showed up to the swim tryouts. That was when we lived in College Station. And I showed up to their high school swim team tryouts wearing swim trunks, you know. That's how out of place I was. So that day that the coach cut me, you know, he was like, you're just not good enough, man. But he told me I'd go swim with the club team, and that's what I ended up doing. Spent a semester swimming with all the 8-year-olds there until I could hold myself above the water enough to finish practice.
And yeah, it's a real discipline. It beats you up. Morning practice is twice a day before school, after school. You spend something like 4 or 5 hours in the water. It's funny because I swam too. I was an AAU swimmer in Miami growing up. And then you didn't just like get on the team. You were the team captain. You were All-American. You broke county records and all this stuff. And I mean, you were sort of like the come-from-behind kid.
Yeah, had a good team. It was one of those things. You had a lot of good people around you, and we definitely did. Our team was pretty awesome. We all kind of pushed each other.
So give a shout out here to your high school alumni and your high school swim team. I'm sure they're probably still talking about you now. So
yeah,
what was the name of the high school? What was the name of the team?
This is A&M Consolidated High School in College Station, Texas. And our coach, he's in the film, and I think he says some pretty cool stuff about that time together.
Yeah.
He's a good dude. He's awesome. We're still friends today.
So you graduated from high school in what year?
In 2010, and then joined the Navy right after that.
Did you go, it was a delayed entry program? Did you have to wait, or did you go right in?
I was in the DEP program for, I think, 4 months.
Because that AW SAR community is so small, there's almost always a wait to get in. They have to like put you in the pipeline, but there's a lot of attrition. The Navy recruiting commercials always show a guy jumping out of a helicopter into the water, but the fact is the attrition rate is murderous in the pipeline for training. It's like 18 months to 2 years of training before you actually reach an operational squadron, and they might lose 80 to 90% of the people who sign up because there's just so many places where you get dropped. It's medical. Water goes up your nose and you can't help it, or you freak out in the altitude chamber, or you lose your mind in the helo dunker, or academics. You can't cut the academics. So if you spend 2 years just going from step to step, just trying to stay in the program, and they don't want you. They make it very clear that they don't want you. Go, leave, we don't need you. So you have to beg to stay. You have to earn it every day. They act like you leaving is no big deal. The Navy is not going to go out of business because you flunked out of SAR school. So you probably remember the graduating class you went to SAR school with was probably a third to half of the guys that ended up starting.
So my original class we started with 33 people, and we graduated with three of those, so four total, including me, started together. And then we had a couple guys that like had fractures or failed. Rolled back into our class that graduated with us, but we had, there's four of us from our original class made it all the way through.
You know, it's funny even going back, because I went through it was August 83, I went through SAR school at HS1 Jacksonville, and they run it now out of Pensacola, but injuries were very common. A lot of guys went out with broken, bad joints, elbows, wrists, knees.
Stress fractures. There's a lot of those.
Yeah, especially knees. Yeah, I think they roll you out now for like shin splints, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, I ran through shin splints the whole time. That was like not a thing. Shin splints was not a thing. They were like, just get over it. You know, take some aspirin. You know, they were just like, you got to deal with it. Yeah, I did a lot of boot camp, and every time I did it, like, you do a lot of running in SAR school. They used to do a lot of running in SAR school. It's a different program than, say, Navy SEALs. you know, tend to build guys up really big. SAR school is really about endurance. It's about having a body that can go and go and go and go and go, not being able to lift 300 pounds. It's more about being able to lift 100 pounds 300 times. So they told us, don't lift weights, run, swim, be an endurance athlete. And when you get out, you're in phenomenal shape. I mean, you're just like, you're doing miracle things, busting a mile in under six, right? Without even really breaking a sweat, do a mile swim and it's a mild inconvenience. You like go back to work the rest of your day and, you know, finish out your day at the squadron. So kind of take it for granted what you do. So you go to go to boot camp in Great Lakes, right? Yep. Did you get in the summertime? Did you get a winter call for that?
Oh, dude, no. I was there in Chicago in the winter, and they got hit by this. They called it a 10-year snowstorm, and we were out shoveling snow until 3 in the morning, and it was piling up over us before we could shovel it all out. And I was like, that was the moment when I realized I don't ever want to live in the North.
Did they still do the fire drills at 3 in the morning and make you run outside in the cold with just a blanket on and call out all 80 names standing there shivering in your skivvies in the cold? They used to do that to us.
We didn't have to do that, no.
Thank God.
No, we didn't. Thank God. That's right.
Thank God. So I think the worst part of boot camp was the fire drills at 3 in the morning in the cold weather, standing there in your skivvies with a blanket while they call off all the names. I'm like, I hope we don't have a lot of long names in the unit, you know, because, and if one guy missed the call, they'd start over from the beginning again. So if one guy didn't answer up, they'd start from the very beginning. But all right, so then on a bus probably, or a plane, they fly you down to Pensacola.
Flew us down to Pensacola and then went through air crew school.
Beautiful base.
Oh yeah, it's awesome.
Beautiful.
It's
one of my best chow in the Navy. It used to be.
Still is that way.
Yeah, Pensacola did you good.
They still do. Yeah, they still do.
So air crewman candidate school is all about the environmental stuff to make you an air crewman. It's altitude chamber training. It's parachute landing training. It's injection seat training.
Yeah, helo dunker.
Helo dunker, deep water environmental survivor training. You're doing mile swims, all dressed out in your flight gear and everything. Steel-toed boots. Those were murder. And you spent a lot of time in Pensacola Bay. They used to spend a lot of time in Pensacola Bay. And you took up sailing there while you were up. You were in San Diego.
That's right, So air crew school, and then you go to rescue swimmer school, and then you go to your A school. And that's all in Pensacola. And once you finish your A school, you go to San Diego. And that's when you learn to be a rescue swimmer in a helicopter.
So you spent about a year then in Pensacola, if you put it all together, didn't you?
Yep, a little over a year, and then just under a year in San Diego to finish the training.
And then the replacement, earned your wings, right? Get your gold wings, get NATOPS qualified?
That changed like just before I got out there. So you used to get your wings. Now it's you get your wings when you get out to your squadron, and you go through their utility crewman syllabus. Yeah. So I didn't get my wings until after my first deployment.
It used to take a while because you get there and you think, okay, here I am. I'm at the squad. And then you're like, no, now you got to earn your wings. You got to qualify as a plane captain. You got to do it. You're back to being a nobody again. So you're always starting from zero every place you go.
Which I think is fair because I didn't know anything when I first got out to my squadron. There's no way I should have worn wings then, no.
Did you have fun in the helo dunker?
Yeah, the helo dunker is a blast, man. We'd all just kind of sit back and let people knock each other out as they're kicking to get out. It's always kind of funny.
So the helo dunker is a big appliance that seats 6 to 8 people. It's configured like a helicopter, and it's basically sitting above a pool. And they strap you in full flight gear, 4-point restraints, and they drop it in the water, and they rotate it upside down, and they sink it. And then you have to basically undo your harness and everything and either exit out the window or exit in mass out the door. We used to say you could really tell the sea dogs that in the helo dunkers, the guys who were comfortable in the water, they were fine. But the guys who were kind of new to it, you could see the wide-eyed stares. There was a terror in their eyes. You can strap me in a chair and drown me? Okay. Yeah. Okay. They have divers that are there to kind of, you know, keep you safe. But some guys balked. I'm not doing it. They'd freak out. Then you have to do it blindfolded 3 times. You have to do it with blacked out Speedo goggles. So I'm glad they still do that training because it saves your life. It really does.
That's
it saves
good.
Your life. So you got some airtime. You go out to San Diego. You arrive at the squadron, and they're going to deploy to land bases and to amphibious landing vessels and stuff like that.
So when I was at San Diego, that was just when I was at the RAG Agency 3. And once I finished that, I was deployed to Agency 25, and that's in Guam. And once I got there, from there, I deployed to the ships, and then we do Station SAR there in Guam.
Guam's a very nice place. It's a beautiful island. Used to have a reputation for being kind of sharky in the water. Does it still have that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of sharks in Guam. So we'd fly over the beach all the time, and you'd just see sharks swimming right in between people regularly. I mean, yeah. There was never a day where you don't see sharks swimming in between people. I have no idea.
Yeah, you have a different sense of the ocean after being a rescue crewman for a while, watching the sharks swim that close to bathers. You have a different view about going to the beach and going out into the water, much more than waist height. You're like, out there are sharks every day.
Yeah, so, San Diego, too. We'd fly over Imperial Beach down there. I'd just see sharks every time.
They got seals in the water? They got seals?
Like in San Diego, not in Guam.
No, San Diego. That means you have great whites if they have seals.
There's a lot of great whites in San Diego for sure.
That's cold water too, man. San Diego's the Pacific's cold everywhere.
It's freezing.
So the air rescue responsibilities, you guys were primary search and rescue responders in Guam. Was the Coast Guard there as well?
Yeah. So there was a Coast Guard base, but they didn't have a helicopter asset. So our main duty when we were in Guam was search and rescue. So we'd work with the Coast Guard, and we'd work with Guam Fire Rescue. And we just stand SAR rotations 24
hours. How many
hours
go as a detachment? How many birds did they send out? To two, three?
In Guam, man, 9, 10 helicopters out there in Guam.
Oh, you went out there as a squadron then? Okay.
Yeah, I was stationed. Yeah, I was there for a little over 4 years. And then from Guam, we'd get, if we weren't on deployment and just in Guam, our main duty was SAR duty and training for deployment. And so when we got deployed, we'd go out with two or three helicopters, depending on what ship we were on. My first deployment was on the Bonhomme Richard, who caught fire in San Diego.
Yeah. She's a total write-off now. They're going to...
She is. She's down here in Texas now, man. They're taking her apart down around the border.
There's a report out about that. There was a whole, just a mess of failures that go all the way up to the front office, right down to like the E2, E3 guys that were manning the ship. It was just a disaster. But, well, I mean, you could get a piece of her now if you want. You could go over there and say, hey, like, I sailed on this ship. I'd like a chunk of it, take home.
I did try. I contacted the contractor that is running, taking her apart down there, and he said, we've gotten a lot of these requests, and we just can't let people come in and see her again. So, all right. He did say that they're going to melt down a bunch of the steel and make challenge coin. So.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
Did
you say you spent 4 years in Guam? That's really something.
Yeah.
That's not bad duty, actually, Guam. I mean, that's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad for like 6 months, and then you're on an island that's 20 miles long for 4 years.
Did you get back stateside very often? Maybe 6 months or so? Get a week or two and come back?
I didn't. Plane tickets were like $2,300, $1,800 to get back, and that was a lot more money than I could afford.
What about Space A?
I could never rely on Space A out there, man. Guam just doesn't have resources you do back in the States. So it's really hard to get back. And
1800 is a big amount of money. That's a big chunk.
Yeah.
How many rescues did you end up doing in Guam? I mean, in the documentary, you talk about it's a different kind of rescue than the normal aviation rescue swarm profile, which would be to cover a pilot who's ejected or a service member who's gone overboard. You're doing rescues of civilians, which would be boats and probably some suicide attempts sometimes. Some people just swim out to sea sometimes and want to end it all. Was it pretty busy out there as a rescue work room?
Yeah, it was extremely busy. We'd get between 60 and 80 calls, rescues a year. Medevacs, we'd have at least one a week, at least, because the other islands in the Marianas Islands, they don't have any kind of medical facilities. Guam was the only major hospital in the area, so if somebody got seriously hurt on, like, Saipan, We'd have to fly out to Oroto. We'd have to fly out there and pick him up and stabilize him on the way to the hospital back in Guam. That was a lot of calls. I had a lot of medevacs out there, and then I had had six good rescues in Guam, and two of them were hikers who fell off a cliff in Guam. And I'd have a couple more. That's what I was thinking about. I have a couple more calls like that, but people wouldn't get in the helicopter. So the family would call and they were lost for a day. We'd go out there and find them, and then they wouldn't want to get rescued.
They want to be found.
Yeah. So
what do you do in a situation like that? You just say, dude.
Yeah. I didn't know how it worked at all. I'd try and tell them like, dude, you're clearly going to die. Dehydrated. You haven't had any food in a couple of days now. You've been sweating. It's like Guam. It's a tropical jungle, you know? No, I can't go back. So you call the pilots back in the helo, and you're like, hey, this guy's not coming in. And like, well, we can't force him. So they just pick me back up on the wire, me and the SMT.
Give him a couple water bottles and say goodbye.
Yeah, we would. We left him. I actually left one guy with our camel back. I'd haven't gotten that back. He still has it. Yeah, but the other two I had on land, they fell off hiking on Mount Lam Lam out there. Those are pretty common land rescues. People would hike and fall off a cliff and break their legs or something. We had to go get them.
That's a pretty gnarly injury too.
Yeah, especially
there's a lot of pain and blood and lots of things can happen there. They've really bashed themselves up. Shock. Did you lose anybody?
No, I did have two recovery missions though, where they were already dead by the time I got there. But the saying is we're not coroners. We can't pronounce people dead. So you have to try and do everything you can until you get to the hospital. But yeah,
that's tough.
Definitely,
you go out there hoping to rescue someone alive, you get out there and you find them gone. That's a bit heartbreaking.
It was indeed.
When did you get out? The other thing. Wait, I'm going to go back to this. You know, fact of life of being a rescuer crewman is. We lose people in operational accidents. The Roosevelt just lost almost a full crew of guys. One crewman survived, the other five were drowned. That in such a small community, when you lose people, you end up knowing them or somebody knew them. While you were in, did that happen much? We had a bunch of crashes while I was in, like 11 mishaps in like 4 years. Did you have those kinds of experiences as well?
Yeah, the big one with the Marines that crashed off of Hawaii, that kind of hit us all whenever I was out there. And then, I mean, recently the one that just crashed off of San Diego with 8 that went down. I mean, we all knew them. Every time, like you said, it's a super small community. Every time something like that happens, you definitely know someone or went through training with them at some point or another.
And it's easy to see yourself in that same spot. Like you always feel like you've rolled the dice every time you go up in the aircraft. And you think, all right, it didn't come up snake eyes today, but it could come up snake eyes in the afternoon. You're always waiting your turn, you're waiting your turn.
That's the best way to describe it. It really is a roll of the dice, dude. It's fun. Like you said, every time you see like that happen, you have been in that scenario before where that could have happened to you. And you're like, thank God. Like, it's just pure luck that we didn't crash over and over again. I think that's the kind of concept.
We had a fire in the aircraft one time coming back at night, and we had an electrical fire in the panel and lost the lights interior. And that when you smell things burning in an aircraft, that's a very disconcerting thing. And you just have to sit there, right? You get the fire extinguisher out, you're waiting for the flames to blow and things to shut down. And we're 100 miles from the ship, and we're like, God, I was like getting into my gear. I was getting into my gear. Told the pilots to tell me to get my wetsuit on in case we have to go in the water. And I'll have the rafts and I'll try and get you guys out. And we'll get our strobes and our radios up. And, you know, the ship will be a couple hours, but they'll get to us. And, you know, just relax. We'll be fine, sir. But I'm going to put on my wet gear anyway. So
start opening up doors so you can get out.
Yeah. Oh, doing all that ditch preparation. We're doing, you know, ditch landing checklist and everything. And then the ship turned the lights on for us, and we were like, thank God, we're going to get back on deck. And the thing about crashes is they're usually very simple things. They're not like things you could predict. They end up being these small – it takes them months to figure out what it was, and when they do, you go, that's what brought down the helicopter?
Right.
Jeez.
Time.
Doesn't end up being a big thing. It ends up being something relatively minor, and you think it took this whole aircraft down. So, you feel it.
Every major incident is a result of Swiss cheese effect, where it's four small things coming in line to cause the problem. It's not one major thing.
Yeah, and you just sit there in the aircraft and have to, like, wait for it to happen or not happen. But it's always there in your head. You always feel great when you get back on the deck. You remember that? You know that feeling when the rotors turn down and all you hear is just the whine of the headphones?
Yeah.
It's like dead silent. You have to take kind of a minute to adjust because you're out of that whole thing of noise and vibration and all of that. And it's like dead quiet, except just for a little feedback in the headphones of your helmet. I still remember that feeling. It's like it's always like 30 seconds or so where you just kind of sit there and take it all in. Yeah, we did it. We're not dead today. Good job, sir. You didn't kill us all.
That's a concept I had a hard time explaining when I got back. It's like flying a helicopter is trying to kill you every time you fly, and you always think you're going to die. And it's different because it's not like, oh, I'm going to die right now. It's like you have a solid 40 minutes to an hour thinking about how you're going to die. That fucks with you on another level. Imagine just thinking for an hour straight, I'm dead. I'm going to die. I have a long time to think about that. That'll mess you up, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like getting a death sentence and a reprieve every day, right? The governor calls and tells you you don't have to, you know, not going to electrocute you. But you're right, because all the losses tend to be at takeoffs and landings. Once you're in the air, usually you're okay. It's the landings and the takeoffs where it all seems to go bad, and it goes bad very quickly. I used to just tell myself, please just don't let me get knocked out. Please let me be conscious. I can get out.
All right.
If I'm awake, I can get out. And but yeah, you're right, because you in bad weather on the ship, you're going to be taken off and you're like, okay, I got to be sweating this. The landing's going to takeoff's going to be okay. Are we minimals on the weather? Are we okay on the weather and the wind? And, you know, we're going to be all right. Is it going to be sleet? You know, and then you're coming back, bad weather, same thing at night, deck's pitching, and you're sweating that for 40 minutes. How's the landing going to be? Are we going to be all right? Are we going to do it?
Right.
Yeah, it's a big relief when you finally get on the deck and you're like, whew. And then it's like, oh, I'm on the flight schedule again for the morning. Oh, I'm
up again. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Try and go and get 4 hours of sleep after that and then go fly again.
Yeah. It's like sticking your head in the mouth of a lion and they're like, okay, see you tomorrow. Bright and early, we'll be doing this all over again. But I'm just getting over surviving the last one and we got to like go right back out. It is. You become inured to certain risks that after you get out, you engage in risky behaviors, because I think a lot of times we have a hard time identifying real risk. Mm. And motorcycles, you know, drinking more alcohol than we should, driving our cars too fast, getting into some like extreme sports and stuff. I mean, we find a certain sense of meaning in living in that envelope of danger. And it's almost like you get hooked on it. It takes a while to get over it. It does. It takes a while. And it took a while for you. When you got out, you left the Navy. You decided not to reenlist. So,
yeah.
Tell me what shaped your thinking on that.
One and done for me. There's a couple, two of the biggest factors that made that decision for me was, one, my back was shot, dude. My back was done by the time I got out. So two of those rescues I had were pretty big tomorrow guys. And you're carrying them in a litter, bent over in the back of a helicopter, and that just, dude, I felt it as soon as I picked them up. I was like, my back's fucked now. Sorry, Custin, I don't know if we can do that with this audience, but
you can do
my
it.
Back, yeah, my back was screwed. It hurt. It still hurts today. And I was like, I can't do another tour flying in these things. And then two was, Guam was not fun, man. I think I was out there with a lot of good guys. A lot of the swimmers were good, but our command was terrible. We had a really terrible command. I guess for context, one time I put in for leave, it was denied 11 times. I never got to go on leave. I still have all of those 11 denials just because they would say we didn't have the manning. We were undermanned out there. So you didn't get to take leave out there, man. And that's...
Oh, wow.
I've talked about that. When we do these screenings, I've brought that up. People are like, no, you're supposed to be required to let people take leave. I'm like, I don't know what to tell you, dude. When you're that far away from the seawall, you have a CO that can just run with whatever he wants, you're not taking leave. If he needs you there, you're not leaving. And I took leave twice the whole time I was out there. And that's not for not putting it in. So I was pretty burnt out. It's burnt out in that command, and my body was
done. They wouldn't even give you a leave on the base. They wouldn't even give you a 2-week break on the base. You couldn't just like check into a hotel and take 2 weeks to sun yourself on the beach and spearfish. They wouldn't grant leave. That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. That's absolutely incredible. It could be just because you're under the op tempo of war. So they're like, hey, we got sea control squadrons in Afghanistan doing stuff, and we got to put out just as hard. And
right.
But it's also, I think, about cuts to the Navy, cuts to personnel, cuts to equipment. They're short of people. They're short of people. That sucks, man, because from what I can tell of you, I think you're a great guy, and the Navy should have done some more things to keep you around. They do burn guys out.
That's what we're trying to fix now, is make sure guys don't get burnt out. We keep assets in the military, you know, keep them healthy.
Was there a sense of things, too, where you kind of said to yourself, okay, I proved to myself what I wanted to prove to myself by coming here?
Maybe not in that respect. I mean, I saw what it was about, and I felt like I did my time. It was more along the lines, like I didn't feel like I didn't need to do anything else.
You were telling me earlier that you learned to sail in San Diego by taking boats out on the recreation side of the base. It was a couple bucks an hour to go out in a sailboat.
Yeah.
Sailing helped. Did sailing help you? And did you do a little of that in Guam too? Was it a
for sure? Yeah, I learned to sail in San Diego. The MWR program, you can rent boats super cheap, and they teach you to sail. And you can do that with the buddies on the weekends. And then when I got to Guam, I'd still do that. And then those two times I took leave, I went to Thailand and then Australia, and I'd sail as much as I could when I was out there. And then when we were stationed in Japan, so before we go on deployments, we live in Japan. We were stationed in Iwakuni at the Marine Corps Air Station down there. I'd sail out of there quite a bit, which is beautiful, man. I didn't know Japan had such beautiful islands out there.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. They've had a lot of time to rebuild them since the war. when you got out of the Navy, what year was that?
2016, December 2016.
Okay. So 2016, and that would have put you, gosh, you were 22, 23 years old then, right? Mm-hmm. You come back to Texas, back to the home country?
Yep, back to the motherland. And then about two months out, I started noticing my body was weird, man. So whenever I was in, I never had any of these issues. And I always felt like I could keep my mind and my body compartmentalized. I mean, you flew, you'd have that saying all the time, compartmentalize everything going on around you, what you did the day before, so you can focus on your flight. And then I think when I got out, it finally all kind of caught up to me. And that hit me at about the 2-month mark. I would be sitting around not doing anything at all, and nobody would be around me. I wouldn't be in a store, be at the house or driving or something. And for no reason at all, adrenaline would just start running through my body. And I didn't know why. That happened a couple times, and I was like, this is a problem. This never used to happen to me. Something's not right.
So your body's still on your flight schedule.
Yeah.
Just many takeoffs and landings, and all right, given the adrenaline and the racing heartbeat, we're about to take off. So
yeah. So there, we actually did a lot of. Steven did. Steven, the guy I did the trip with, LRIC's. His whole academic career was based on combat veterans returning back to the States and what their bodies go through. So he got his PhD in that. Yeah, and all the research he did, you know, really shows that when your body operates on that level for years on end, always thinking you're going to die, right, and that much adrenaline run through your body, it doesn't just turn off. So when you go live a slower pace, your body is still used to operating at that tempo, so it'll still release adrenaline for no reason at all, because that's what it's used to do to keep you alive. I had no idea, and that scared the shit out of me. And then with that, you know, then you're getting mad, pissed off all the time, and I had a real problem coming back.
Veteran suicide in this country is a major issue. Upwards of 22 veterans a day commit suicide every day in this country. And there are an awful lot of organizations that are working to try and mitigate and reduce that risk of suicide among former service members. And that wasn't any different for you, Taylor. At one point, you had a very, very bad day and you put a gun to your head and you pulled the trigger.
Yeah, I got there. Not proud of it, and it's still, especially when you do these screenings, you relive the most embarrassing moment of your life over and over again. It sucks, but when I got there, when I got that low, dude, I broke down in tears because I didn't want, like, John and Kel and Adam, my buddies I was overseas with, to feel that alone. Like, they didn't, there was no other way to live through this. So that's how Hell or High Seas started, and that's why we set off for Cape Horn to kind of document what was going on with my body and what I was going through, and so they could see that they weren't alone.
And a minor miracle happened. When you pulled that trigger, there was some sort of misfire or malfunction. The primer did not actuate that charge, and it did not put a bullet into your head. And you had a moment to pause and think about what you were going to do going forward after this sort of second chance was given to you, by divine providence or by pure happenstance and luck, because I assume you know how to take care of a weapon. It should have gone off, right?
Yeah, you know, it should have.
Something should have happened. So something saved you, and you decided, okay, if I'm not going to die, I better get on with living. And you decided to buy a sailboat. You bought a put 20 grand into a used sailboat and decided you were going to sail around Cape Horn in it, which is like suicide by another means. As I watched the original part of the diary, it's like, hey, he's just going to kill himself a different way here trying to do this. What was it about Cape Horn that excited your imagination and made you say, this is the quest I have to fulfill? I've got to go to the farthest end of South America between the devil and deep blue sea or so to find my life again. Tell me about that.
Yeah. To bring it back a few steps, I still, after the round didn't go off, I didn't give a shit about living. I didn't care about being in this world anymore. That didn't change. And so it wasn't like I need to start living now kind of thing. And I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy that it didn't go off. It really wasn't, genuinely. But I wanted to make sure that the guys didn't go through that. That was the only thing that I came away from that with, was I wanted to make sure nobody else ended up like that and felt that way, because you feel pretty fucked alone. Steven's actually one who kept me alive, man. I can credit that to him for sure, because I call him and talk about his research and everything he'd seen with the combat vets he's interviewed coming back, and he's like, dude, everything you're saying is exactly what every single person I've ever interviewed has said. What's happening in your body, where your mind's at. I was like, what the hell, dude? How come we don't know this? You know, how come this isn't common knowledge that this is what it's going to be like when you get out?
Right.
And so that's when the conversation started. It was like, well, let's use this and reach every guy getting out of the military. And that's when we kind of decided was the only way to do that this day and age is through media, through film. So we decided to do something in this world that we could film and talk about PTSD and how it affects your body on a physiological level. And we're like, well, if we're going to film something, it's got to be pretty badass, and people are going to have to want to watch it if they're going to pay attention. And so we're like, well, it's either going to be Mount Everest or Cape Horn. And we're like, well, Mount Everest, you know, you pay somebody to carry your stuff to the top of the mountain and you take a month off and go do it.
But
I think it's going to be Cape Horn. So we decided on Cape Horn, and yeah, then that's when I got the boat and fixture up. And
cinematography was beautiful.
Started filming.
Yeah, the cinematography is beautiful. Some of the footage you captured of the wave action was just, I mean, my head was rocking. I felt myself, like, you know, leaning into the sea state there. Your footage in Patagonia was beautiful. I was like, it looks like Norway. You know, like the glaciers and the fjords. I was like, God, it looks like Norway. It was absolutely gorgeous. But you had, on this journey, it took you, it was over a year, wasn't it?
Yeah, just almost 2 years.
Yeah. And
we left in 2017, got back in 2019.
And this was the biggest boat you had ever sailed?
About, yeah, I guess that's fair to say, yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah,
those of you who are listening, you have what amounts to a novice sailor taking a fiberglass bottom boat And normally you would want it to meet a steel, rocks and wave action that's, you know, batter a boat like that to pieces. Nice. And he sailed it, and you sailed it 6,000 miles. Is that about the mileage? 6,000?
Just under 10,000.
Just under 10,000 miles through probably what is the most treacherous passage of water in the entire world. And I got to tell you, it's an amazing feat. I wonder if you still understand just what an incredible thing it was that you guys actually pulled off. Because I watched the documentaries, like, I don't think they understand what they just did. They just sailed 10,000 miles on a Ritz cracker around Cape Horn and lived. It's absolutely amazing. I kept thinking, watching, and the documentary, folks, is Hell or High Seas. And we're going to arrange for a screening for some of our members for you guys to watch this. And I've been working with your people on this. We're going to arrange for a screening. Taylor's also got a veterans organization where he is wanting to take veterans coming back out of the military and help them in their transition back to civilian life by adventure therapy, by sailing. And also, I think there's a sense of crew that you miss when you get out of the military. Very close relationships among the guys we serve with. And when you're cut off from them, you're cut off from them. It's like when you step off, you step outside the veil again, you're a civilian, they're still in. And there's a divide there. And it's a weird feeling. So having that sort of crew of guys who are veterans to reassociate with and rebuild yourself around, your tribe, so to speak, I think it's a very important part of that veterans transition. So I can see what you're doing is going to be very helpful to guys. So we'll be looking to raise a modest sum of money to help his organization. You also have a line of tequila out that you guys are doing, which I'm surprised it isn't rum, given your sailors. It really should be. It should be rum.
Yeah.
Tell us the name of the tequila and where people can get it.
Yeah, it's called Cape Horn Tequila. And it's not on the shelf yet, so my bottles are stuck in that traffic jam off California. December 10th is our day. It's supposed to be November 1st, but we got pushed back a month before we get bottles here.
And you're using the proceeds of that to fund the program.
Hell yeah, man. Yeah, that was one of the biggest things on our expedition was keeping it going. So we had a couple of sponsors that we were out there, kind of left us high and dry, and we were at a bad spot. So when we were down around Cape Horn, you know, another one of those moments, you know, when you're flying and you think you're going to die. We were on a boat and we're pretty sure we were going to die. And we're like, well, if we make it back alive, what are you going to do? And mine was to keep these going and start a company to do that. And so that's Cape Horn Tequila, and funds our veteran expeditions once we get them on the shelves.
You got to watch this documentary, because I'm a sailor myself. I began sailing in middle school in Miami, Coconut Grove, and crewed on a boat that sailed in the Bahama Islands for, three different summers I spent out there. And there were some moments of your journey there where I thought, I know they're not going to die, but they really should die, because they're doing something that is like super dangerous. You had a jib boom break free. You had to ascend the mast in a bosun's chair in a high sea state, adding about 180 pounds of top weight to the top of your mast while you were securing that jib boom. And I was like, okay, this is dangerous. You guys got thrown overboard at one point where the nose dived into a wave. You and the other SAR swimmer, you guys were out there. There was two SAR swimmers, you know, in that movie. I was like, oh my God, there's like more crewmen than I've seen. And you guys got washed off the boat at one point. I think you were trying to secure the jib or something, weren't you, or mainsail.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull the main down for that storm.
And you guys pulled yourself back in. You had a harrowing experience with pirates in the middle of the night where a storm basically rolled over you. The clouds covered the moon. And, I mean, there's some like great stuff in this that you had this incredible. I mean, the only thing that didn't happen is you didn't get run over by a tanker.
I know.
That was
close. We had a couple of those close calls.
You had the Humboldt Kurt drag you 700 miles out into the Pacific off of Chile. And I was like, that's a long way to be in that boat. Because what was that? What was the boat? 38 feet.
36
feet. And in the video, dude, it just looks like a bathtub on those waves. I mean, it is such a spec. The drone footage you guys had was great. Because I was like, this got to be drone footage. They have a drone. They're flying. You guys run out of food. You run out of water. You did a GoFundMe when you were basically stranded. And gosh, you raised your goal in like a week. People threw the money. People were at you there to help you get, you know, to keep you going. It was really an incredible outpouring of support from people watching you on the journey.
A lot of active duty guys contributed to that. And then a lot of our community in San Antonio and College Station. And WellMed. WellMed's this healthcare group. They're one of our big sponsors as well. That was one of the coolest moments of the trip, was seeing everybody kind of come together and realize that this needed to be done, needed to be talked about.
You have a PTSD diagnosis, I'm assuming with the VA. Yep. I'm assuming you probably also have some disability because of your back also with the VA. Yep. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, about dealing with the VA and how that experience has been? Anything you can tell people about, lessons learned, about things that they could?
I don't really have anything good to say about the VA, if you're looking for that.
No.
That was part of the problem, man. Whenever I got to Pensacola and I started going through all this and I had a problem, I went to the VA and I checked in and saw a psychiatrist and diagnosed me and said, well, the next time we can get you in is in 4 to 6 months. And I was like, I've told her in that moment, I was like, what the hell am I going to do myself in 4 or 6 months? For real. What's going to happen, you know? So I left, dude. Got out of there, and VA's not going to help. You know, we got to do this ourselves. And kind of not related, but that's kind of what I think. When you see all these nonprofits popping up to stop veteran suicide, PTSD, it's not because they want to, dude. It's because there's a need. It's because guys are killing themselves and nothing's being done because there's a six-month wait at the VA to get help. I think that says it in itself, how much the VA is lacking. And I don't think it's the people that work there. The people that I work with are awesome, are great. You're so overwhelmed, man. There's 19 million veterans in the States. How many VA stations are there? It's ridiculous.
It's like 1,100. There's like 1,100 facilities around the country, and they don't seem to be able to see anybody, which is like, what are they doing?
I have that in Houston, dude. It's one of the big ones. I went to Houston. Right. Like for my back, for instance, I went to, I know we're just bitching now and I hate doing this, but I think guys are going to get out.
Yeah, you know, it's informative. It really is.
So I went to get an MRI at the DeBakey down in downtown Houston, and they said, okay, you can come up in 3 months. We'll have an opening for you. Okay. So I don't want to go already. Right. Samantha is telling me, she's like, you need to go and you go get it.
Samantha's your wife.
Yeah. Sorry. And, you know, she's the one pushing me to go to the VA. I don't want to work with the VA because it's always been a negative experience. So I'm like, okay, fine. All right, I'll go get it set up. I'll go through the process. They're like, okay, 3 months, we got you. The day comes, dude. Well, it was the day before I was supposed to go. I get a letter in the mail that says my appointment's canceled for no reason. Like, it just says your appointment's canceled. I've been waiting for 3 months for this thing. There was no explanation or anything, so I haven't tried again since then. It's a mess. So that's why I'm pretty adamant on doing this ourselves and taking care of guys ourselves. I think it needs to be done because there's a lot of guys like that are just getting pushed under and not getting any help.
There's a side of me that thinks that veterans are the guys who should be doing that. Because,
hell yeah.
Because we have an insight into this that's very different than the, especially when you've experienced. I got to make a confession here, and we talked about this a bit before the break, but when I was in the military, PTSD existed, and we did not acknowledge it for what it was. And it was downplayed. You were living in a culture in which you just couldn't say no to things. You didn't show any fear. You didn't balk at anything. You charged straight ahead. And whatever the challenge was, you went after it. And if somebody got a little a wobble, as we used to say, we looked at that as being, oh, well, the guy just can't hack. And
yeah, you're the weak one.
That's still a problem today. And it's not about weakness. It's about, and then I told you, I had nightmares for a couple of months after I got out. It was a recurring nightmare, the aircraft crashing in the water, and I couldn't get out, and I would wake up. I never knew that to be what I thought it was. I mean, I never knew what it was. I just knew I'd had these nightmares, and I didn't. You shuffle them and drink a little harder, ride your motorcycle a little faster, and hope it doesn't come back. And then It did. It subsided. And then about 20 years later, somebody sent me a video of a very, very hard landing of a helicopter in bad weather. And I had a full-blown cold sweat, heart racing, shortness of breath, thought I was having a heart attack, and didn't know what it was, and then realized what it was. I was having a flashback to that experience. My body was reacting to the video as if I was going through the experience again. And it was very disorienting for about 2 minutes while I thought, what is happening?
And
The way I got through was I kept watching the video over and over and over to sort of like make it go away. And I would, each time the symptoms would get lower and lower and lower to where I can watch it now without this lump in my chest and this fear. Because you do, you feel it. I could feel myself in that aircraft trying to make that landing and thinking, you're going to die. This is not going to go well. And they're filming it. So you're going to die and it's going to be a movie. And now I have a different appreciation for PTSD. But there is a culture. It's not just in civil society where people don't understand. A lot of times in the military, we don't understand it either. We see it right in front of us, and we don't react properly to it. We don't get these guys help and treatment. I want to go into something else here because standing on the outside as a spectator in your life, public life now, you have a very public life. The movie Hell or High Water is brutally honest. I mean, you're not holding anything back. It's very, very personal and even intimate. I feel like I know you, even though I don't. But I do know what it's like to be you in the context of being a rescuer. And getting out of the Navy is a journey from military service back to civilian life. And as I watched that movie in the aftermath of what happened, I see you like going from, I'm going to drink this bottle of tequila and shoot myself to, I've sailed the Horn of Africa. I have a successful foundation to help other veterans. I'm married. I have a 2-year-old daughter. Dude, you've made the journey. You're back. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like you're back?
I want to live in this world again, for sure. I still have my days. That's I don't think that's going to go away, but I know that this world's worth living in again. I learned that on the trip, and that's why I started the Sailing Foundation, because I want other guys to see that. But when you live in those storms and then you see a sunrise come out, or you go hike some glacier that nobody's ever seen before in their life, it makes you want to live. It makes you want to be a part of this world again. I found that out there. So
well, now you get that. Now you get that 2-year-old, man.
Right.
And to her, you are the world. You know, you are the world. Yeah, no, I gotta say, I gotta say this. So much of the coverage of post-traumatic stress disorder and veterans issues is about the guys who die. But I think there needs to be more emphasis placed on the guys who live. The guys who walk up to the edge of that cliff and decide not to step off of it, turn their lives around, and get on with living and make the best of their lives. And I think, given the challenges and struggles that you've dealt with, I wish I could shake your hand and give you a hug, because you're doing it, man. You step back away and you're on the right. You're back on course again, right? You're out of that doldrum, and you've got a life with purpose and meaning. You got wind in your sails again, and you got a sense of direction and purpose back in your life. And so many guys don't get that, and you see them, sitting in their garage just drinking beer and not living, and you're out there getting after it. And, from one sorter to another, man, I'm just like, you're doing a good thing. You're doing great. And I'm proud of what you've been able to do and what you've been able to accomplish. And I think there's more there for you. I think there's more coming from you. I'll get you a link to High Mountain Heroes. We did a documentary on Put Guys in the Alps, very similar to the same kind of experiences, for the same reasons, about reconnecting to living again through nature. So I don't want to keep you too long. I know your daughter's napping. She's going to pop any minute and start sounding off. I just want to say what a pleasure it's been to talk with you today. And I hope our readers come away with a better understanding of who you are and issues related to PTSD and how to come back from that and how to rearrange your life, find that redirected purpose towards living, Don't be one of those 22. Be one of the tens of thousands like Taylor, who's back on course again and sailing into a nice southerly tack. I want us to stay in touch. I want us to stay in touch. And you have an open invitation from me as editor-in-chief. If you want to write anything for us, we'd be happy to publish it.
Wow, right on, man. Yeah. We'll definitely talk when you come to Houston, right?
Yeah, I will. I have your email and your cell phone. I've got your stuff. I'll make sure you get a free hookup with software as well, so that you can be.
I'll wear it on the boat.
Yeah, and when that tequila arrives, let us know how we can get a bottle or two. And if I get one for me, I want you to sign it for me.
Oh, definitely.
It'll be a trophy edition.
Definitely, most definitely.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to conclude the broadcast today. This is SoftRep Radio. I am your stand-in host, Sean Spoons, editor-in-chief of SoftRep. And on behalf of all of us here, we just want to thank Taylor again for coming. His fine movie, Hell or High Water, Hell or High Seas. Come Hell or High Water is the phrase I'm thinking of. Hell or High Seas, there's a website, hellorhighseas.com. It's a beautiful movie. You really have to see this. And watch this very personal journey of a veteran coming out of a military service and reconnecting back with his life and his humanity, which is the other thing I think you really found out there too, is your sense of humanity. So congratulations on your fine film and your progress here coming out of the services, your transition back to civilian life, your beautiful family. And I can't wait till we get a chance to talk again. You're welcome here anytime.
Me too, man. This was great. Great chat. Thank you for having me. It's really cool.
Thank you.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.